What's up, Internet? Welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This week, I'm joined by Deputy Editor Nathan Ingram. Hey, Nate.
Good morning, Devendra.
Good morning. And also Podcast Producer Ben Elman is here. Hey, Ben.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. Hello. It's a week of the New York Auto Show, which we've been covering. Specifically, Sam Rutherford has been there quite a bit, and he couldn't join us because he's taking some much-needed rest. But we'll be talking about some of the news he wrote up there and other announcements from the show. As they relate to like EVs and the cars that Engadget typically covers, there's some fun stuff there. And there's also some really stupid stuff going on in the world. And we will, of course, dive into that. Like over the weekend, just multiple tariff stuff. Like this tariff is on. It's impossible to keep track of. We have been following all that. So we'll dive into that stuff. And hey, there's a whole bunch of other stories. There's a really great NPR report about how Doge was taking sensitive labor data. And we'll dive into kind of what all that means. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. And you can also join us Thursday mornings around 11 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel. We do live stream there. We often do Q&A. We show off gadgets. It's a fun time. Join us. Also, stay tuned to the end of this episode because I'll be interviewing Isaiah Saxon, the director of The Legend of Ochi. It's a new movie about a young girl who finds a, I don't know, mysterious forest creature that she's trained to kill and she chooses not to. We'll be talking specifically about the special effects involved in that. And if you like old school special effects, like old puppet Yoda, old fantasy films, there's a lot of that. This movie has a great mixture of CG.
Practical effects.
And practical effects. It's beautiful.
They do any miniatures?
There, I believe there's a lot of miniature work, too, but it's mainly the creatures look amazing, so stay tuned for our chat around that. All right, let's dive right into the New York Auto Show, and I feel like people were really interested in what Kia was doing, because Kia, I feel like, has been really killing it with the EV6 and the EV9, and they have announced the Kia EV4, which is their first electric sedan. Just pure sedan. It's not a little hatchback like the EV6. It's not a big SUV like the EV9. It is a sedan that looks like you kind of chop. Honestly, it looks like you chop the EV6 off a bit at the end, or like cut off a bit. This is a cool
looking
car. Yeah,
the cutoff at the trunk is definitely throwing me off a little bit.
Yeah.
But it does kind of fit with like the design language of the rest of their cars. That's maybe not how I would have done it, but I'm not an auto designer, so.
Maybe it's just the angle of it. It kind of looks like a coupe or coupe. I can't even tell.
Yeah, when you look at, there's a shot directly from the side. It looks a lot more standard than the one at the angle, I would say.
Mm-hmm. This is a cool car. I don't know. So Nate, you and I have talked a little bit about EVs and kind of where we're headed. I know Sam, as he's been testing this stuff, he got a really good lease for the Mustang. Yeah, the Ford Mustang EV, which not many people like, but they ended up putting out cheap lease deals out there. So like top level advice from what I'm seeing, especially as people are looking at getting cars ahead of like whatever tariffs are going to do for prices. Don't buy new EVs. Like, don't buy them outright. Leasing them, you may find some good deals, though. And as always, buying a used car, there are some good used EVs out there. I don't know about jumping into Tesla at this point, even though their prices fell. But buying a used EV is a good idea. Like, the Hyundai Ioniq, there are a whole bunch of those from 2021, 22 that are out there for decent prices. So,
yeah. My question about getting used at this point is mostly, like, are you getting the same – like. I feel like there's a lot of advances happening quickly in the space, right? So like a car from 2022 might feel a lot older than if you got like a more established platform, right?
It depends. It depends.
Years old, but
yeah, if it's more about like how hard people have driven the car, how much have they recharged the battery? Has the battery degraded somewhat? It is true that, you know, charging standards have changed quite a bit over the last few years. So if you buy a used car, you will not get one. Like I think the newer cars tend to have the Tesla connection, the North American connection. But kind of not a big deal. You could still plug into other chargers out there if you are going to be charging at home, which most people are going to be doing. I feel like that gets lost a lot in the EV discussion. Like the whole idea is you're buying this thing that you can most likely recharge quite a bit at your house, and you don't have to go to gas stations often. You will
unless
probably
you're a
be
road
fine.
Tripper.
Yeah, unless right. you're a road tripper. And honestly, there that's where things kind of get rough and get tougher. But yeah. Good EVs just don't hold their value, I think, because the tech has changed so much. But the actual quality of the car is still like you've got CarPlay, you've got the good tech. Because I'm still seeing, I've been like considering buying a second car is just like a thing that could be really helpful for our family, because sometimes the kids have to be in different places, or me and my wife have to be in different places, and a cheap EV is kind of ending up as the same price as like a Prius from over 10 years ago. It's kind of wild. It's kind of wild. Like, crazy. Yeah.
I was, based on your prompting this yesterday, I looked at the Ioniq 5 from, I think, 2022. I saw one that had about 50,000 miles and it was like low 20s.
Not bad.
Seems like a great deal.
Not bad at all. 50,000 miles in a car, especially an EV where you don't have like transmission issues. That's good. That's not bad at all. Let's talk about some of the other stuff from the New York Auto Show. Subaru also showed off their second EV, the Subaru Trail Seeker, which
It's
very Subaru. Looks a little
wagon-y. I love Subaru.
Yeah.
And they're sort of killing me a little bit because my car is
12 years old. Did you see the new Outback?
And I'd love... What's that?
Did you see the new Outback?
No, I did not. But I know, basically, I'm like, I want them to make either a good hybrid or a good EV, and they haven't really done either yet.
Yeah.
Although this year, I think they're finally putting out a Crosstrek hybrid, which is their like little crossovery thing. But you know, I'd rather have a straight hatchback. But this is a car that I consider buying. It seems like the Trail Seekers is using their old platform. They haven't fully transitioned to like whatever it's going to be. And I'm just like, why? Like, I'm sure there are lots of reasons why, but it's just taking them so long to like get on board with this stuff. A few other car makers are like that too. Like Toyota only has one EV still, and it's not very good.
They were behind because
they're killing the hybrid game.
Yeah. They're sharing Toyota's EV platform. So that's kind of why Subaru and Toyota feel a little behind. Those folks were so successful in their own like field, right? Toyota was just like, hey, everybody wants our hybrids. We don't need to worry about EVs. Subaru is like, we're going to go after the outdoorsy folks, the people who want very specialized cars. And they have always really kicked butt there. So I want to show off the – look at the new Subaru Outback, which is
– yeah.
I'm not a fan of this front end. I'm not a fan of a lot of this. This doesn't.
It looks like the Forester to me, which is
like. It looks like a Forester. It looks like more like a
US. In between like a big SUV and like the wagon that the Outback was.
But the Outback has
want wagons, right?
Slowly gotten bigger and bigger. They've made the Outback more, less wagon, more of like a mini SUV almost. And this one just like full on SUV, but it's also ugly. It's just so ugly. I mean, I'm looking at this thing. I don't like the front grille. I don't like the weird boxy lines of it. Definitely
the
looks
front
like
of cars in general are so aggressively huge these days.
Yeah.
I'm just over it.
Unless you're
it's
an
like,
EV.
Let's just end it with a square.
Yeah. So the Trail Seeker, Subaru's second EV, kind of looks a little sleeker, I think. I think the front doesn't look as aggressive and it looks very Subaru-y. If you're in the market for that, that's something to pay attention to. Kia is also doing a Nightfall edition of the EV9. This is a white one with like black accents, black wheels, black trim. Even the inside, the seats are black. I really like the EV9. If I could lease an EV9 right now for under a decent amount of money, like that probably would be worth it.
It's a big car.
Yeah, it's a beautiful car. Genesis X showed off the X Grand Equator concept, which is a...
That hood is wild.
This whole thing is wild. This is a luxury overlander concept. We don't even know if it's an EV, but from the front of it, given that it has no grille, this is most likely an EV because it has kind of a Rivian, you know, bar of lights.
Some
of that. But big wheels, big front. This just looks cool. This looks like a car you'd see in like Mad Max or something.
It has some like weird, it does retro future in a way that I don't hate, unlike many, many other cars, I feel like.
Yeah. Lucid showed off the Gravity, which is their, Lucid has had an EV they've had like a sedan for a while. But the Gravity is their big SUV play. It looks really cool. I like the look of the Gravity.
For this one, they're saying up to 450 range and 200 miles in 11 minutes. So for me, I'm like, that's the car I could take and drive around, you know, both at home and way out into the backwoods of New England and not have to worry about the charging quite so much.
You could. I feel like people are overplaying like a normal gas car, right? Like my XC90, fill up the gas tank, it gets 300 miles. But you assume like, okay, you can find a gas station and recharge. 400 miles, like how much are you going to trek through New England, you know, without finding
a charger? No, I mean, it's true, Like I've been going between Boston and Philly a few times recently. It's like I think about that a little bit, but that's, you know, that's the furthest I'd probably do in like one day, like a six. I mean, unless I'm like really going for it. So yeah, it'll be
so
fine.
Boston it's just to like, Philly, I think, is that like 400 miles? 300, 400?
Not even. I think probably closer to 300 and change.
Oh, wow.
And so I'm like, yeah. right on that line where you could do it in one go if you had a, like, basically, I'm like, I want a car that can reliably go 300 miles on a charge.
And that's, with that, I mean, I would be like, those numbers, and again, PSA for anybody considering an EV, those numbers are very hopeful. Those are very hopeful numbers, because if it's hot in the summer and you're blasting your AC, that number is going down. If you're going too fast in the if it's cold and you're pumping the heat, that number is going down. If you don't have a heat pump, which some EVs don't, which is the more efficient way to generate heat, you're going to be using more of your battery to generate heat if you're going too fast on the highway. So that's kind of the main reason to get a really high range EV, is because you're taking into account all these things that could be killing your battery life. If you're going way too fast on the highway, that's kind of one thing. Hyundai also showed off an IONIQ 5 NTA spec, which looks, it's a race car. It's a cute little race car performance spec. I didn't see this one. Maserati GT2 Stradale.
Yeah, he just added this because it's a bonkers, you know,
it is bonkers,
high performance traditional, you know, ICE, which is fun to take pictures of. And Sam takes awesome pictures, so
this is true. Oh yeah, so this is,
I'll allow it.
This is not an EV. Don't buy Maseratis, people. These are bad cars for people who think.
Keep
they
going
look
though.
Cool.
The next one.
Yeah.
Oh, so what I'm not seeing is many pictures of the main driver consoles, because remember a few weeks ago we were talking about how there's too much screen in all of these cars, and Europe is actually changing its standards so that you actually need more buttons.
Yeah. Yep.
Thank you, Europe.
Thank you, Europe. I don't think you can get inside views of some of these because of, I don't know, how they block off the cars. But that is a good point. This Maserati, again, Maserati is for, they are not high quality, expensive cars. If you're going to dump that money, there are much nicer things you can spend money on. This one looks cool. I wish I would love to see more EV concepts from them. This one down here is really funny. The Chrysler 6 prototype.
Yep.
Is this did they make an EV version of an old school Chrysler, or is they just remaking the old car?
I don't think so. I think they just it was a prototype from 1924.
Oh wow.
But at the time it was cutting edge, and inflation makes it about a $29,000 vehicle.
This is a literal 1924 prototype, so it's not like an updated version of it. That's what I was thinking at first.
It looks really cool, but like, who is going to be driving this around? Like, that's something that you drive around on Sundays just to have people say, "Oh wow, look at that old car."
People do that for sure. But yeah, if you one of my favorite movies is Miller's Crossing, you know, the Coen Brothers movie. And this is the 1920s gangsters would be driving the Chrysler 6 or something like that. So it is cool. But I want to talk about the specs, because it was the industry's first four-wheel hydraulic brakes, a six-cylinder engine, whopping 68 horsepower. You'd have some amazing races with Tommy guns in this thing. It is cool to see. Like, it's cool to see old cars alongside the newer tech. Always a fun thing.
You know what this is reminding me of? This is a really nerdy one, but in Forza Horizon 5, you can get some, like, really old cars, right?
Yes.
And their rating is, like, D out of, like, you know, up to, like, S2 or whatever. So they're very slow. And so one time, just for kicks, I decided to use one of those in the, like, 30-mile, like, around Mexico race that takes, you know, 18, 20 minutes when you're in the car that goes fast. And this just took so long. And there's no way to pass anybody because you have no power. So you're just, like, four cars in a line going very slowly. And, like, maybe you'll drift or draft and pass one of them. It was ridiculous. I couldn't finish it. It was taking far too long. But
you're just going to put around those things.
Yeah.
For listeners, this is a good time to look at if you have been thinking about upgrading your car, if you've been thinking about getting another car, whatever the tariffs are going to do to new car prices and even existing car prices, like, dealers are going to mark those things up. It doesn't matter if this car was already on their lot and all of a sudden it's worth more. It's because the market is going to make it worth more, sort of like what happened during COVID. So now is a good time to look if you need something. I will tell you all. Go ahead.
I was just saying, demand for used obviously is going to go up. In the same fat, right? Like,
yes.
It's going to drive, like, new stuff a bit too expensive. People will get used. The used prices go up. It's just all going to be bad.
And new stuff.
Who knows?
New cars are almost always too expensive. They are never a good deal financially because the minute you drive it off the lot, it's worth, like, significantly less. The sweet spot is, like, a 3 to 4 year old car that has been has come right off lease, is not too, doesn't have too many miles on it, is still relatively modern in terms of tech, but you can get a really nice car for much less. But it's wild seeing what's happening to some EVs, because I've been looking at like the BMW i3, which is that cute little sucker that they've been producing since like 2013, 2014. And it looked really futuristic when it came out. And you look at that car today, it's still like, man, you look different. You just look kind of cool. And you can get that for under $15,000 for 2014 to 2018 model years with not too many miles on them. The downside with a lot of those older EVs is that you really have limited range. It's like the Nissan Leaf. So I wouldn't buy a really early i3 because you get like 70 miles of range, you know, max. But the 2017 and beyond models, they added a bigger battery that can get up to 125 miles. And that's not too bad. If you just want like a little commuter to take around town or to like drive in your local area, most people do not drive that much. And I think like something like that, it is a cute little guy. I was giving myself a go. What can I find for under $15,000? Because I don't want to give up too much money right now. Who knows what's going to happen to the economy? How much is food going to cost in just a few months? Who knows? I was initially being like, I could just get a dumb, boring Prius, right? The Prius V, which is the wagon version of the Prius. And again, that's in under those prices. But a lot of Prius Vs are more expensive than this BMW i3. I was looking at the Volkswagen e-Golf, which is really cute sucker too, like a cute little car with basically 100 miles.
That was
range.
Barely available here, though, huh? Right?
It was barely available here, but
for a couple of years,
it's still. I mean, they made it for a while. There are a lot of these models online, like on Carvana and other places. So people like it too. So I've never really considered that car before because of the low range, but as a little around town car, that's not bad. Like I would totally do it for that price. So let us know, folks, if you are in. Or if you're doing this kind of research, what are you finding when it comes to cars? Are you considering, an EV with a smaller battery? Because I think if you rarely drive beyond like 50 miles in a day, which is a lot of people, you don't need a big battery. You can kind of just make that your little around town car. Maybe you have another car for road trips or whatever. I will also say, stay tuned for more news from the New York Auto Show. We may be there later on. This thing is running into next week, so there's probably more stuff coming out of it. Stay tuned to Engadget for more news from the New York Auto Show. Let's jump into some other news. And here's a breaking story that's actually happened as we started recording this podcast. So I've not fully read it yet, but basically New York Times is reporting that a judge says that Google is a monopolist in online advertising technology. And this may sound, I don't know, familiar, because a judge ruled a few years ago that Google is a monopolist in search. So This is a whole other time, like another strike against Google, basically. Here's a quote from the ruling judge, Leonie Brinkema. In addition to depriving rivals of the ability to compete, this exclusionary conduct substantially harmed Google's publisher customers, the competitive process, and ultimately consumers of information on the open web. Separate part of the quote, part of that business stems from the acquisition of DoubleClick. Oh, I remember this. An advertising company, for $3.1 billion in 2008, Google now has an 87% market share in ad selling technology, according to the government, end quote. Yeah, we've talked about this, and we've talked about like how Google being such a search advertising giant honestly has been bad for the internet and has been bad for Google as a product company too, because they just cannot escape this. Nate, any thoughts on this? Because I feel like you're a little more Google friendly than I am. You're a Chromebook fan. What do you think?
I mean, I would say that in the last couple of years, I've definitely started to try and diversify my usage of their tools with other things. But yeah, this is not a huge shock, but it's still a huge deal. Given that, yeah, so the ruling that they were, the antitrust ruling over search was only last August, so less than a year. And some of the remedies that have been proposed from that are really, would really change the company in a major way. Like I think spinning off Chrome was one of the things the government wants them to do. And I think like negotiations over that are going to go on for a long time in terms of what actual things that they have to do. But now you add this onto it, and between the two, you know, the New York Times says it could reshape the $1.88 trillion company, which, yeah, would be absolutely wild. I think the question now, obviously, is how much will that happen under the current administration, which is not unfriendly to monopolies, I would have to say.
But they hate big tech, is the thing. Like, they do hate the big tech companies in general, right?
True. I mean, yes and no. They've all been, you know, kissing the ring. So I don't know.
We'll talk about that.
There's no way to know. Any day there could be a different opinion, right? But yeah, like, I think we'll have to see how this plays out in terms of like what the remedies are and what the courts force Google to do. But yeah, I mean, between last year's ruling and this one, like, there's going to be change afoot for sure.
And we talked about the thing about bringing, like, basically branching out Chrome and how, I guess it kind of sounds good on paper. And honestly, I would like to see what that looks like, because I think Google is just bad with its products, right? Google was a search giant that became an advertising giant. And I feel like that just dominated everything. And it's also the reason why we've lost products like Google Reader and you know, Google Wave and other things too. But they just couldn't monetize them in the same way, or those things were a distraction from the core business. Google has never been a product-focused company in the way that Apple has. Honestly, even in the way that Microsoft has, you know? So these are things that have always bugged me about Google. So if you let Chrome be free, be its own thing, maybe that makes Chrome better, and maybe that makes the entire, you know, that could make the entire browsing industry better. I don't know what you do for search.
Say the same about Android, right?
Like, yeah.
Let that be its own business with its own concerns, and you know, focus on like being better there.
It could. I mean, Android is just so much more pervasive. But yeah, that is certainly an idea people popped out there. I don't know. This advertising business is Google. You cannot break that out of Google. So they would have to do like a Ma Bell type thing where they could just like split up into several different companies, maybe, which, you know, that helped for a while, like from the old AT&T.
Until they all just came back together.
They all came back together, or like in different forms, like a future administration will approve certain mergers. And it's just like a cycle we keep repeating. But this is really interesting to see, and kind of related to this,
yeah,
too.
Actually, can I broaden this conversation?
Go for it.
To
go for it.
Talking about just legal momentum and as it's continuing into the Trump administration, because we did see some new stuff about the Facebook antitrust case as well. Just to take a single step back, the US v. like Google LLC thing started in January of 2023. So this is something that happened during the Biden administration and went on into the Trump administration. We'll see like where that goes. In the case of Facebook, it started under the Trump administration. It started in
the very end.
Yeah, at the very end of the first Trump administration in late 2020. A lot of the analysis on this case was saying, like, yes, like Facebook probably has reason to be accused of being a monopoly already, but a likely reason that the Trump administration took this up in the first place was that Trump himself was annoyed at Facebook for doing their like 2020 election integrity work, and the idea
kicking
that,
him
that
off
might
the platform too, like they removed his account after the whole January 6th thing. Like, there's a lot of reasons.
This was filed. This original case was filed in December of 2020.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
So this was before he got kicked off due to January 6th stuff. I think it was literally just like, I'm annoyed that I lost the election. I think the election integrity stuff hurt me.
Yes.
There was all of this information and like all of these kind of postmortems in those couple of months between the presidential transition and everything, where they talked about how like the playbook that they ran in 2016 cratered in 2020 for a bunch of different reasons. But the funny thing is that the original case that was filed by the Trump administration ended up getting thrown out because it didn't have like enough good information. By time it got thrown out, we had the Biden administration, we had Lina Khan, so they tried it again. And this case that's currently going to trial, that Zuck is currently on the stand for, or has been on the stand for the last couple of days this week, is a Lina Khan case that they are continuing with, probably still because Trump is saying like, oh, well, I'm anti-big tech. I'm annoyed at big tech. Zuck tried to kiss the ring so many times. He donated, or had Facebook donate, $1 million to the inauguration fund. Offered $400 million to make the case go away to the FTC. FTC was like, no, $30 billion. Zuck was like, what about $1 billion? FTC was like, no, $30 billion.
And because, they were pointing to the WhatsApp acquisition. They were pointing to the Instagram acquisition. Instagram was $1 billion. WhatsApp was $18 billion.
Yeah, so just it was a huge acquisition.
It was a huge acquisition. And also, Meta settled a $25 million lawsuit from the Trump administration, from Trump directly, to kicking him off the platform. So there's a lot of money flowing around here, and a lot of kissing the ring, and a lot of like Zuck literally brown nosing, like just being such a brown over the last year. Anything else you want to add to that, Ben?
Well, I mean, let's say that they kicked in between these couple of lawsuits and the donations to the inauguration campaign. It's in the realm of $30 million, give or take. You know, it might be $27-28 million. And look where that got them.
Got them. And also, not even that. The sort of philosophical changes Zuckerberg has made, removing fact-checking, removing the things that were potentially blocking conservative speech. Those were all the things that the right has always been pissed off about from big tech. And he kind of just like, okay, no more of that. No more of also policies that were about basically, was it protecting equal language or something like that? There was policy about protecting how people were referred to in general. A lot of like, just,
I mean,
like,
that,
hey,
like, falls
we
under
care,
the DEI umbrella as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, we care less about actually building a fair platform that's devoted to truth all the time. We will allow some garbage, and do you like me now? Do you like me now, Mr. Trump? It's kind of how it's
They're
felt.
Very much like pushing it towards like the X model, I would say, which like, I think you have to figure like given the environment that they think that would make them more favorable towards a Trump administration.
I mean, let's be real. Yeah. Like Twitter, the Twitter that was the one that started Community Notes. I think that the X model of using Community Notes as the only moderation is like the big shift.
That is it. It was old Twitter pre-Musk that was doing Community Notes. And I think that was like a good-hearted effort, because I've seen Community Notes has been really useful for a lot of things. And honestly, Community Notes has worked against Elon Musk quite a bit to people. And he is spouting garbage. Like, people will immediately shut him down.
So the Facebook antitrust case is absolutely a developing story. And we will see what happens with both of these cases. I mean, Dev, I don't want to get too far into talking about Microsoft antitrust yet again, but like, you can rule that a company is a monopolist, and it can still take a heck of a long time to suss everything out, right?
It took a long time. It was the late 90s when Microsoft was ruled to be, you know, a monopolist, and then some of my first stories writing in technology in like 2010. It's like, oh, here's the outcome of that.
Yeah.
Here's a pop-up warning to tell you to choose which browser is in your system. It also seems like, looking at it now, I feel like a lot of those protections have just gone away. Because if you try to install Chrome in a new Windows installation, when you go to the Chrome website, you'll get a pop-up like in the browser saying, hey, you've already got a great browser. You don't need to get Chrome. And Edge is there by default. Edge is your default browser. If you try to make Chrome your default browser, there are some pop-ups that are just like, hey, are you sure? Do you need to do this? Yeah.
So what you're saying is that it's actually kind of a Dr. Manhattan moment, where it's like, it is 2002 and I'm writing about tech antitrust. It is 2022 and I'm writing about tech antitrust.
I mean, it's 1980s. You're writing about AT&T antitrust, you know, like it is.
I feel like it's secular. Like, all these companies like will like, not all of them, but certain ones will find this lane and become so massive and so powerful that like eventually it becomes obvious to even an idiotic government that something needs to be reined in a little bit. But like, each time, I think the test is like, what will they actually do about it? Right. Like, there was the AT&T thing, they got split up, and then there's Microsoft, and there was some degree of you know, whatever, wrist slapping that didn't feel super significant to me. And then this time, like, the proposed things that the government wants to do with Google because of the search antitrust case were pretty significant. We talked about, you know, Chrome obviously being rolled out. There are some other things I'm not remembering right now, but like, I was like, oh, this would be like, if they got what they wanted, it would be pretty wild. But the negotiation for that will surely take forever.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, ongoing story. We'll be keeping an eye on all of this. And we're saying this because this week that whole case is actually happening, you know, so there's been some reporting of Zuckerberg being
the Meta one specifically.
The Meta one is happening this week. He's tried so hard to just block that, and all of his efforts just have led to nothing. It is kind of read the who was it? Wall Street Journal had a good report called Inside Mark Zuckerberg's Failed Negotiations to End Antitrust Case. There's a lot of, he just looks so desperate and so sad and literally just give up any, I don't know if this guy has ever had like actual political ideals or philosophical ideals, but like he just like will give up everything to avoid spending this money or avoid the government taking some action against them.
I mean,
think he has. No beliefs.
He's not a great crusader. Stooge looking for money. Yeah. Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah. Combine this with like what we found out with Sarah Wynne Williams' book, Careless People. So I think that's where we should leave it. Dev, let's talk about tariffs.
Oh, joy.
It's, I joked before we started recording this show.
Tariff Thursday.
It feels like we're not just living in enemy of the state territory. We're living in like enemy of the stupid state because it's all.
We're also living in like the 1890s where we're talking about, or not 1890s, the 1920s, 1930s with Smoot Hawley and all that.
and that Chrysler.
impending depression, recession leading to impending depression. You know, it's a lot of stuff we're talking about. But yeah, over the weekend. Bear with me, because a lot of things happened. but our story right now is that electronics have been exempted from reciprocal tariffs, but will soon be subject to new semiconductor tariffs. And this was a journey, because I remember seeing the story, I think it was Friday afternoon, a story dropped that in general, electronics would be exempt from tariffs altogether. And then the Trump administration came in over the weekend and be like, no, that's not forever. We're actually going to have a new category for those. We're going to have more data about what those are going to be eventually. So
there's a few hours of rejoicing.
And I told a lot of people, especially like some centrist-y friends I know, like, do not rejoice. This is just like there is something else going to happen. Either he's going to completely change his mind or there's going to be more details about what's going to happen. And that's basically it. So anyway, this all came after, let me read Cheyenne McDonald's reporting from Engadget. Let me see here. This all comes after Trump imposed a 125% tariff on goods from China. And that was in addition to the 20% tariff. And that brought the tariffs against China to 145%. China itself applied like a...
Of course,
a reciprocal tariff.
I was going to say that this, of course, was almost a week ago now. Yes. So, like, I don't even know what the China number is at this point. It's probably
the numbers are all over the place. But then the Trump administration imposed a 90-day pause on other countries, the stupid tariffs that we were talking about weeks ago. But that pause doesn't.
This was just
China.
Last Wednesday.
That was last
Wednesday. The stock market shot up, and then it went right back down because they're like, "Oh wait, there's still tariffs on China.
Still happening.
Maybe.
Yeah. We will see." So here later, the newly published exclusions would exempt many devices and parts from both the 10% global tariff and the steeper tariff on China, according to the notice published on Friday. But there will be future semiconductor tariffs. So that will apply to chips, that will apply to electronics and gadgets and everything. What we said last week still applies, folks. Everything is going to get more expensive. Everything. So be prepared to repair your devices now. Get everything in working order. If you need to upgrade anything, probably do that now. I'm more worried about things like cost of living and food and all that. But there are so many things that are just kind of a disaster about all this. And kind of related to this, too. Sony announced that PlayStation 5 prices are increasing across Europe, UK, and Australia. This comes after they already raised prices in Japan.
At least some of those regions, yeah.
Yeah, in some of those regions. So
yesterday they announced they're bumping up PlayStation Plus pricing also, which obviously different than hardware, but kind of part of the same trend for sure.
Let me see here. Only the PS5 digital edition cost is changing in Europe and UK. It'll increase to €500, $570, from €450 and to £430, and from that's up from £390. So decent chunks. And Sony in the past, like this was way before the whole tower thing, they were blaming the supply chain. They were blaming the fact that it was harder to make the PS5. And now it's just like, hey, yeah, the world is going to get, it's just going to be getting tougher, I guess. That's kind of what they're saying, right?
Yeah. I was just thinking about when you said upgrading and stuff. Like I have my iPhone is about 2 years old. It still works pretty great aside from the battery life. It's awful. And I'm like, maybe I'll just put a new I'll just go to the Apple store, pay $100 to put a new battery in it and ride it out for another couple of years. And
yeah, if the battery
see what the world looks like then. Maybe society will have collapsed and we'll be, you know, stripping our phones for parts.
Yeah, maybe we'll have bigger problems than new iPhone.
Horizon Zero Dawn stuff, baby.
But I also say, like, yeah, if your battery is good, like, your phone will continue to last for a long time. And I don't know if you're hyped for Apple Intelligence. I don't know if anybody should be super hyped for Apple Intelligence. So it's like, not a big deal either. I will say I have done interviews where I've done like the voice memos thing because I have a 15 Pro Max. So that supports Apple Intelligence there. Voice memo auto transcription is a very nice thing to have. Just to sit in a place absolutely. And have the words come in and also have that saved immediately. And I can like refer to that. Stuff like that is useful. And if you have, I'd say a very, very old phone, it may be worth upgrading to be able to do some of those things. We're also looking forward to like, what are the new devices going to be from Apple this year? There's the thinner iPhone people are thinking about. There's the worry that iPhone prices in general will change. Wasn't there a story that Apple products will essentially be exempt from some of these tariffs too? I have to double check that. But yeah, we know everything changes. Literally the next day, something could change. So there's a lot we don't know here. And yeah, any other thoughts on PS5 prices or just like rising prices in general, Nate or Ben?
Yeah, I just think, like you said, like the spending power of people is going to go down. And like you said, I think it's probably more crucial to think about stuff like your savings and your cost of living stuff, your you know, rent or homeowner payments and food and all that good stuff. But like, yeah, I think people are just gonna have to like keep stuff longer. And you know, a PS5 is a lovely luxury, don't get me wrong, but, you know, like, if you have to save for an extra 2 months to get it, like, is that really the end of the world?
I kind of
don't think, comparatively speaking, you know, we'll just have to see what it turns out to be like. I'll be very curious to see what iPhone pricing will be like in about five months. Like, that'll be kind of one of the bellwethers, I think, for, like, what it's going to be like, because if they... you know, bump prices on everything by $200 or $300, like that will radically change things.
We're still waiting to see what Nintendo's going to do, right? We still don't have US.
Right. We still do not have a pre-order timeline.
I am mentally preparing myself for the possibility that the price is going to go up. I also remember when the PS5 Pro came out and we were talking with Jess about, she's like, you don't need it, but it's really, really great. And I asked, you know, my frugal question of like, how relevant is this machine going to be? Because it feels like we're at the end of this console cycle. And she said, actually, the console cycles are getting longer and longer, so it might make sense to get a PS5 Pro. I'm personally going to try to goad one of my friends into getting a PS5 Pro so I can buy their PS5 standard. And it's going to be interesting to see what the like device manufacturers are going to do with the rollouts for the new consoles, depending on what the economic picture looks like when they're ready to do that announcement.
I mean, I would say the PS5 still has easy 5 years left because
until
about 2 years ago, almost every big game was coming to both the 4 and the 5.
Right? A lot of games are still coming to the 4 and 5.
They still are, but like there's at least, you know, Astrobot's exclusive. You know, there's a handful of others that are going PS5 only at this point. So like that writing is on the wall. But like you said, if the console life cycle is longer and the hardware is more powerful, like, yeah, they'll just keep it around for longer. So like I would say, yeah, if you don't have a PlayStation 5 yet and you're cool with buying one as a, you know, 5 to 10 year purchase, like, yeah, maybe get the Pro if you really care about this stuff, because you'll just have a better experience at the tail end of its life cycle, right?
If you have a nice TV, if you have a nice sound system, you really want to like see these games running at their best, like the benefits of the PS5 Pro are there. Go check out my review. But also,
I was going to say, you reviewed it also.
I reviewed it.
Just checked it out. You checked it out.
And okay. if you don't care that much about that stuff, though, buy a used PS5. Buy used, buy refurbished when you can. There are so many ways to save money on products like this. And I'm like, I do this for everything. Like, I like a lot of Dyson products, like their vacuums, like their weird little gadgets. I never buy a Dyson product used.
Do they have a good refurb store?
They have a great refurb store, and you can also buy refurbished from other places. There's always a gamble. It's like buying a used car or anything else. There's a gamble of like the quality of that refurbished device. But for me, I have never run into any major issues. I've had refurbished Roombas and all
sorts
of stuff.
On the other hand, I can personally attest to Dyson customer service being really, really great. And if you have like an issue with like, you know, one of those little hoses that like you can't really replace because it's such an Apple product of a vacuum, they will just send you a new vacuum. So
I was gonna say, speaking of Apple, I can't remember the last time I bought a brand new Mac or iPad, because they're refurbished stuff. It comes out pretty quickly, you know, maybe 6 months after the new one's released, you'll find refurbs. You'll save $300. They're same warranty. They always physically are fine. Like, yeah, I've been buying refurb Macs for like 15 years now.
So Nate, one more question before we move to the next topic. If you were to guess how much life the PS5 has left and how many of those years are overlap years with the next console, what would you say?
I would say, so it's 2025. I would say new console in 28 or 29.
Yeah.
And then the PS5 continuing to get game support with new releases for another 2 to 3 years, probably. So into the 2030s.
Wow. Whatever you're thinking the that PS... long?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's only 5 years away.
It's not that
crazy, but
we're creeping towards
it's upsetting.
And come to think of it, like, the PlayStation 6 may be the last, like, typical console in general to, like, a thing under your TV that is only for video games. Because who knows what Microsoft is going to do? Like, everyone's thinking, like, we will see a handheld for sure. They can just diversify their business into other ways. They don't have to be the super powerful box under your TV. That box can be other things. So Nintendo just gave up on it entirely. It's just like, hey, it's a thing in your hands, and occasionally it's a thing under your TV. So
yeah, I mean, I think there will be a PS6 most likely,
yes,
but
yes,
there is a world where I could see video gaming having moved to whatever the next iteration is going to look like.
I'm saying Sony will be the last one standing as like traditional console makers, basically.
Yeah.
Okay, we got to get to our last piece of broccoli now.
We got a bunch of
Devendra. Stuff. Tell us about that whistleblower.
Yeah. One big story that dropped from NPR this week, written by Jenna McLaughlin, I believe she also did the actual audio report too. It's called "A Whistleblower's Disclosure Details How Doge May Have Taken Sensitive Labor Data." It's really long. Took me a while to read. It's kind of technical. It's kind of deep, but I think everybody should read this. If you listen to this podcast, you should read this. This is a deep recounting of how Doge basically jumped into the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, which is an organization that investigates and adjudicates complaints about unfair labor practices. So that's stuff like union building and stuff around unions and stuff around like employee complaints against companies too. One of their IT people basically has become a whistleblower who has divulged like a lot of the details about what Doge has been doing. His name is Daniel Barulis. Also, by the way, what an IT guy face. Like, this guy looks like every IT guy I've worked with. Like, yeah, you could just stamp out clones of IT guys at this point. But he was somebody who said he wanted to serve his country and help people. He thought this organization was going to be the place to do it. He was kind of shocked by seeing what those people have been doing. And that involved putting in backdoors in the networks, it seems like. It involved a massive spike of data that was taken away, and they don't know what data it was. And it's a wild story, because at one point he was personally threatened, like quietly threatened in the way a mob boss would threaten somebody. There were pictures attached to, I think, his office door of him from an overhead view from a drone. Like looking at him walking his dog, there was personal information about him in there too. Just like a veil threat, like, hey, shut up, stop stop asking about what Doge is doing.
Was it
literally, we know where you live.
Yeah, we know where you live. We know what your dog looks like. We'll get
was
your dog,
was it specific
too.
Talking about what kind of drone? Are we talking about like a predator drone, like black and
no,
white?
No, consumer drone. Okay, predator drone. About consumer we don't have predator drones running in America. Not yet.
Allegedly.
Not yet. You wouldn't, and those things are really loud and huge, so you wouldn't know. But no, a consumer drone can totally do this. But the whole thing is that this is a wild story. It shows the extent to which Doge has been siphoning data, and everybody within these organizations are trying to fight against it. And we just don't know. There's a lot of personal information here. There's social security information. There's information that could be used by Elon Musk when it comes to things around SpaceX, because I believe SpaceX employee complaints went to the NLRB. So there's stuff that could be relevant to Musk internally. There's stuff that could be used by enemy actors outside of the state. Once the Doge employees started opening up a hole in the NLRB network, they noticed pings from like Russia from an account that was using from an IP address that was using the correct username and password that the Doge people have created. This Russian entity kind of knew that and was trying to access it as well. I don't believe they actually got access to it, but we don't know. There's so much we don't know. But what the hell Doge is doing? Where has this data gone? What are these people really up to? It is a wild ride. And this whole, when I said enemy of the stupid state, that's kind of what this feels like. It feels like the movie Enemy of the State, which is great, but was also more about like a vast government conspiracy. No, this is more like a really stupid thing we're doing of like highly technical people stealing data from government agencies for the dreams and ambitions of a billionaire and maybe his president lackey. So wild story. Check it out. It's worth the read. It's very long. And yeah, great to see NPR doing reporting like this, because I've been a little disappointed by some of their sort of like equivocating in other reports around Trump and Doge and other things. So this has been great.
This one feels on the level of the stuff that Wired has been doing, I would say.
Yeah.
I feel like Wired was the first to like really get on top of Doge and like do lots of in-depth stuff like this, and this is kind of the next phase of that. And you know, I would say agree with you. I'm glad to see some of our reputable publications continuing to chase these stories.
Good to see Wired, and also like good to see like in general tech publications just feel better equipped to detail some of this, because Doge is so directly tech related. 404 Media has done a bunch of great reporting. Wired's ready for this. Jenna McLaughlin has been a cybersecurity reporter for a long time, so she's just not like a random NPR person either. So this is great. This is good to see. And I don't know, maybe we will have some action against Doge because of all this. And what we are seeing is like a little bit of mayhem out in the real world too. There are reports that crosswalks in Silicon Valley were hacked with like AI versions of Zuckerberg and Musk voices. Go check out the videos around that stuff. It's really funny to see. I think there are reports around one in Seattle too, or near Microsoft.
Extremely dystopian, but funny just to like crosswalk and then like hear it talking to you. Only qualm about all this is like it messes with accessibility for people who maybe you know, vision or hearing impaired as they're trying to cross the street. So that's not great. But
maybe you could work that into your anarchic hacking, you know, like work that in. Hey, walk. Mark Zuckerberg says walk.
Well, I'm going to drop some examples of what the crosswalk said into the audio episode. But imagine you press the button at the corner, you get, you know, whatever sound like that tells you, yes, you press the button, like wait. And then a voice comes on and says,
hi, this is Mark Zuckerberg, but real ones call me the Zuck. You know, it's normal to feel uncomfortable or even violated as we forcefully insert AI into every facet of your conscious experience. And I just want to assure you, you don't need to worry, because there's absolutely nothing you can do to stop it. Anyway, see ya.
Some quick sweet news. Also this morning, hey, there was a Nintendo Direct about Mario Kart World details, and this game looks good. I just want to say, like,
it's real good.
If you want a distraction from kind of what's happening,
everything we just talked about,
well, not fully tuning out from the world, but also there are those reports that playing Tetris could help you, you know, avoid forming traumatic memories, right? It feels like it's playing any video game, doing anything to like distract your brain
almost
for a little
any
bit.
Video game,
it kind of, yeah, can kind of help with that. And Mario Kart looks like it. there's a jumping mechanic now. There is that jumping mechanic you can use to like drive on the wall for a little bit.
That's cool.
A lot of fun little things, just like rechanging, like basically flipping the way we think of Mario Kart. I love all this stuff. I've played a lot of so much Mario Kart 8, but even more now that my daughter's into it. Nate, I feel like you're a bit of a Mario Kart fiend because we used to do office battles when we could.
Yeah, God, that was a long time ago. Yeah. Shortly after the Switch came out, mm-hmm. we would play. We would play in the office after work. I've loved the series since the first one. I got the first one on Super Nintendo. Many high points, few low points. I remember the DS
Double
one
Dash
was
a low
on the
point.
NES.
Yeah.
In Mario Kart 8 was great. I didn't spend as much time with it as I did with the other ones, I think. And I'm like, you know, maybe I need to go back to it in preparation for Mario Kart World.
I mean, it's
World
only
looks awesome.
It's only a couple months away, I guess. But yeah, go back. You own it, right? So you can spend
time
with it.
Just, you know, and I've played it a fair bit, but just not like, you know, I haven't like beat every course or like seen every single thing you can. But
I had to buy another copy of it because once my daughter started playing, I was like, oh no, we both need to play. And oh no, I need another copy of this freaking game.
Does she have a Switch Lite or something?
She has a Switch Lite that she plays and it's perfect for a kid, perfect size and everything. Also want to call out, there's a rewind feature. Very much like the Forza Rewind, which is kind of cool. If you miss a jump or something, like these tracks look really complex. Like you can jump, like rewind and try it again, but doesn't rewind for everybody. So other people keep driving. You are rewinding.
You have to weigh.
Yeah, the cost benefit of like, am I going to try to do this or am I going to keep my lead or whatever? Fun stuff. And also the game just looks amazing. Like it graphically looks amazing. I cannot wait for this world map and whatever.
It's a perfect launch game because I think you'll be able to put so much time into it. So even if there aren't a lot of other like Switch 2 exclusives right at the jump, like having one this good is the way to go. It's not Zelda, but it's got a similar, I think, kind of scope where you can just like lose yourself in it for a long time.
For sure. And also this is a game we will be playing forever, for a very long time. Look at how long Mario Kart 8 lasted. You know, I bought that on the Wii U back in the day.
That's wild, yeah.
So yeah, we'll keep seeing it for sure. Let's move on to stuff from around the gadget. Hey, I want to shout out my review of the NVIDIA RTX 5060 Ti, the 16 gigabyte version of that. Pretty decent video card. This is like their higher end, low end one. Like it's under $500, but it has a lot of RAM.
Higher end, low end.
Yeah, top level, low end. I don't know. It's under $500, $429 for this particular model. But of course, prices will explode. Already in the GPU industry, it will be even worse once tariff stuff hits. It is weird that this one has 16 gigabytes of RAM when the 5070, which I did not like as much, that one has 12 gigabytes, I believe. So very, very weird. Very weird choices by NVIDIA this time around. I think for a lot of people, the 5060 Ti will be a smarter buy. And they also announced that, the plain 5060, which we have not tested yet, that's going to be $299. It's going to be coming sometime next month. Guess we'll see what it does. But the 5060 Ti, really good for 1080p, really good for 1440p, can do ray tracing. Frame generation helps quite a bit. I got some really high frame rates, and I was playing a bunch of Overwatch 2 lately. I've been getting back into that. Easily over 300 FPS with DLSS, but in 1440p at max graphics. That's pretty good. That'll fill out most 1440p screens. And if you have a 1080p screen at a really, really high refresh rate, you know, it'll be even more. I'm also kind of related to all this. I'm testing a 480 hertz 1440p monitor, so this will not fill that out. You need a much more powerful video card for that. But, you know, kind of where I am. That's why I'm testing Overwatch 2 now. What are you up to, Nate?
480 hertz.
480 hertz.
Excited to see what you think of that. Yeah, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, I have been testing the Lite Phone 3, which is a super minimal, super basic phone.
That's still too expensive.
Still. We can talk about that after I publish the review. But the gist is like it doesn't have a lot of tools on it, so you don't get sucked into doom scrolling, which, you know, given the state of the world, I kind of appreciate. Mm-hmm. That said, it is definitely not the kind of thing I could use full time for a number of reasons. Surprising to me, the biggest one is that it doesn't really have autocorrect, so using it for texting is really tough, and especially given the way people text now as like real time back and forth conversation and not just like I'm on my way messages. Like, it's fine for that. But if you want to have like an actual text conversation, it quickly goes downhill. But it's still, it's been fun and interesting to try for sure. And then other than that, I reviewed The Last of Us season 2 and did a little recap of the first episode.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so that's there's 6 more, so it'll be going on until mid-May or whatever. So far, so good.
Let's move right into our pop culture picks then, because I feel like we both have thoughts on Last of Us season 2, and I've only seen the first episode so far. They're already making some tweaks to the way we have experienced The Last of Us 2. I was not the biggest fan of that game because I feel like there was one like overarching theme that just beat you over the head with over and over again. I did find season 1 of The Last of Us show to be more nuanced than the game. So maybe this season, also upcoming seasons too, right? They're splitting up part 2 into 2 seasons or more at this point.
My guess is, so having seen the entire season, my guess is it'll be 2. Obviously, you never know, but okay. I would have a hard time seeing them stretching it out.
I need to talk to you about where this season ends then, because I'm really curious about that. But yeah, there are things we're waiting for.
No spoilers.
Things happen early on in The Last of Us 2. I'm like, when are you going to do that? When are you going to shock the world, I guess? I don't know.
Yeah. I think that it's going to be... I think I would agree that, like the show, like the first season, it'll be a little more nuanced. You know, I think that the thing that the first season did well was, like, they aren't unstoppable killing machines because they're not video game characters. So as a result of that, like... Ellie's like in part 2, her like rampage through Seattle is going to have to be more realistic, right? Like, you're not going to see her kill 50 people in this season because that isn't possible. But they are ratcheting up the presence of the infected, which I appreciate. They feel more of a constant threat. You know, taking on going one-on-one with them, it feels like a dangerous thing in this world, and I like that.
It's good stuff. We had a short glimpse of Caitlin Dever as Abby. Two, who is the significant other main character in The Last of Us Part 2. I love her as an actress. I've loved her since Justified. She has been fantastic in everything she's in, so I think she is phenomenal. I'm a little sad she does not have the killer guns that Abby of the game does, because Abby in the game is like huge and buff and everything. But Caitlin Dever is great.
Yeah. I heard Craig Mazin or Neil Druckmann talk about that. I think the gist was like, in the game, that was so she played differently, which makes sense. And they don't have to worry about that in the show. So they're like, we just want to get the best person.
This is true, but also you don't really get to see like buff female main characters like that very often in the games. Like, it was just strikingly different for me. So that was a kind of cool thing. But also, shout out to the Last of Us podcast. I love that they're doing that. Craig Mazin, you know, what's his name? Voice of
Troy Baker.
Joel, Troy Baker is hosting it, so it's kind of cool. You get a bit of Joel voice, and you get hear them talking about it. I've listened to when Craig Mazin was doing Chernobyl. He did a podcast around that, too, and it was really interesting to listen to. So very, very good first episode. You're a fan of the second season overall?
I am. I think I have a few quibbles that I'll save for when it wraps up. It's a tough story to adapt. And I think they're doing a really interesting job with it. The changes they've made are smart. And the one that I'm seeing most people bump on was the introduction of Abby and her crew at the very beginning of episode 1. Most people I've talked to who have played the game are bumping on that a little bit and saying it feels like it's going to remove some of the dramatic tension.
It's just different.
I'm curious. I have a few friends who didn't play the games who are a big fan of the show, and I want to see how they feel about it. Since they're not going to be comparing it, they won't have that same experience. But like, I'll be curious when it all wraps up to be like, if they tripped up on that at all.
The main difference is that in the game, you're playing as Abby at a certain point. There's like no context.
Right.
You don't know why you're this character. You don't kind of know what's happening. And the reveal, slight spoiler of the game, but the reveal that she's a Firefly comes later, a little bit later. But it also felt like, yeah, of course she is, dude. Like, who else are we? What other humans are around here? It never felt
right.
Like
it was exactly like in the world they've established in the show, like that mystery is a little less crucial, I suppose.
Even in the game.
I think they need to get people on board with understanding who she is faster, just because of the nature of watching something every week versus playing it in, you know, multi-hour stretches or whatever.
For sure. So I cannot wait to see where this goes. There's also some other, like, Love, Death, and Robots has new stuff coming. I talked about the latest season of Black Mirror last week, but yeah, that's fantastic. So great time for sci-fi stuff.
The Pit last weekend. Yeah. So good.
So good. Give Noah Wyle the Emmy now. Basically,
he's such a great dude.
Good dude, good actor. Great stuff all around. Yeah.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Nate online at...
I am at Nate Ingram on Threads and Blue Sky.
And you can find Devendra online at...
At Devendra on Blue Sky, and I podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
Don't at me at heybellman.bluesky.social. It's such a long domain now. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes, because I promise that helps. And subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.
Stay tuned for my chat with Isaiah Saxon, the director of The Legend of Ochi. Isaiah Saxon, thank you so much for joining us in the Engadget podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you. And my first question for you is, watching this movie, which is an original concept, not a reboot, not an adaptation of a comic or something, which has a lot of practical special effects, as somebody who watches a lot of movies, this Legend of Ochi feels like a miracle. How did you get this made in this fashion with practical effects and everything?
Well, the attempt to make the film took longer than the making of the film. So yeah. You're right in assuming it's a challenging environment for films like this. This is the third film that I wrote and was ready to make. And the previous two were too big. And I think it's extremely hard to reach kids with your first film, because kids are kind of behind this kind of corporatized IP world now.
Right.
But I really wanted to reach kids with my first film. And so that's why it took so long. And by the time I wrote this, I was like, this is my small little tiny movie that I'm going to make the duct tape version of if I have to, you know? And what I did was just immediately start drawing the world, making detailed concept art, and just trying to make a watertight case for production companies and studios. And every time I would get a little bit of money for development, I would spend it on prototyping creatures with John Nolan Studios in London, or going to Romania to scout locations and show people where we were going to go and what it really looked like. And so through the 3.5 years of this work before I got a green light, I had then accrued this visual package that was kind of undeniable. And that's when A24 finally just said, okay, we're going to be bold and risky, and this isn't what anyone normally does, but we're going to, believe in you here. So
it's kind of cool. Yeah. There aren't many studios that are kind of going out on a limb, I think, for movies like this, I'm sure, as you've probably seen by now. The thing everybody talks about is the fact that you've got puppets, and you've got so many puppets, or at least a large focus on puppetry. Can you talk about the choice to bring in a puppet that I can't think of too many movies that have done this recently. I grew up with Yoda, and I grew up with the 80s fantasy children's movies, you know, which were just so alive. And to me, puppetry always feels like it's grounded with the actual actors. What's your thought on puppetry as like an artistic medium, and why did you want to make that kind of the centerpiece for Ochi?
I think puppetry is such an ancient art form that, we've been making shadows on the cave wall for thousands of years. And our brain, as we watch the human hand give life to a character, is just fully accepting of it. You know, the first time I tested the puppetry here, we had a furless, naked prototype, and five people standing around it with rods. And if I looked at the puppet, I was sure this was a living being. This was an entity. Your brain just is so accepting. So, and then there's also the charm of like the failure space of puppetry. Even when you're not doing it just right, it feels alive. And especially for this baby primate, we found immediately as we were testing the puppet that the little imperfections that came through rod puppeteering were actually exactly the way that a little baby monkey would be just discovering how to move their own body. There's like an imperfection to it in which they're actually they're not mechanically smooth either. Yeah, so there was never a second thought about puppetry versus anything else. It was just, I wanted a real animal. I wanted to make not a movie creature, but a animal that, you know, kids might be able to be like, did I miss the BBC nature special on this? Like, this feels like a real being. And so, yeah, especially at our budget, you know, it had to be real. You know, the Planet of the Apes films cost $200 million. Like, this is an indie film. So that's not going to happen. And even when it does, despite all of the incredible artistry and craftsmanship, there's still, your unconscious knows something is going on. This isn't exactly real.
Gotcha. Yeah. Can you talk about like what goes into the puppetry? Like, I've listened to a couple interviews with you, and it sounds like there's a whole team involved. There's somebody kind of directing the entire team. I grew up on the Muppets and all the Jim Henson stuff too. So it's like, this is, it just feels, it feels kind of refreshing. It feels kind of a throwback to me. Can you like break?
Yeah. So our head puppeteer, Rob Tigner, he worked on all those Henson masterpieces, you know, so he's been around. Nice. He worked on The Labyrinth and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Nicholas Roeg's The Witches, which is one of the biggest influences.
The Witches, a nightmare film that I saw as a child, but also, also, yeah, I feel like it kind of embeds yourself, it bends itself in your subconscious a bit, and as a kid, your kid mind is just working on that in a weird way. I feel like Ochik really reflects that kind of sensibility. Is that, was that part of your goal?
Thank you. Yeah, 100%. The Nicholas Roeg's The Witches is the touch point from my childhood. Like, I didn't see E.T. until I was 25, you know, and so you know, this movie does not come from a nostalgia for 80s creature movies whatsoever. It just comes from like what I find fun to do. Like, and all of my films, I like to draw and sculpt and build stuff. And that's my approach. But getting back to how the puppetry exactly works. So we work with John Nolan Studios in London. They had just done Jurassic World. They are the best in the world at this. And they were lovely enough to do our little film, you know, with a $10 million budget and $1 million for creatures. And they pushed the limits of what you could do at a really small scale with animatronics. And, you know, we were able to prototype for years to build these creatures. And then on set, you know, we have extensively rehearsed every single scene with all these puppeteers, which are, there's five on the body, led by Rob Tigner, who's doing the head, and he's kind of calling out the internal monologue of the animal. All its thinking, all its vocalization, so that everyone can sync, because there's also two people remote controlling the face looking at monitors. So they all have to become one entity. And we're removing them all in post. And in order to even get to the point that we're shooting, we've done rehearsals where we've built all the sets to very specific dimensions to fit the ergonomics of the situation so that we can hide them, or we can place them, you know, where they can access. And so anything with the puppet has to be shot in that way. That's a custom built environment. And then with the suit performers, you know, we have small people in ape suits with hand extensions, with heavy animatronic heads that they can barely see out of, that are hot, and they're out in the Carpathian wilderness and the mountains of Transylvania. So yeah, across the board, it's really challenging to orchestrate all these things, but extremely rewarding and fun. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. It's, I think a lot of people are pointing to Amblin and the stuff, that sort of film as sort of a touch point for this, but it feels to me more, I'd say Miyazaki, I'd say. And that's something I noticed in your music video for Bjork for Wanderlust. There is that great sense of like the connection between children and nature in this. Can you talk, like, was that an influence for you as well?
Yeah, I mean, Miyazaki's on the, he's on the Mount Rushmore for me.
Oh, yeah.
He's deeply impactful to my whole path in life. And more than just the aesthetics, which are also deeply influential, it's like his perspective on life and films like Princess Mononoke, where he's aligned with the kind of chaos of nature and the equality of nature. And it's not an anthropocentric, human-centered lens, which is one of the limitations I find in most films. And, you know, this film comes from a place of wanting to respect the aliveness of all beings, you know. And I think Miyazaki influenced just that philosophically for me as a young person. And yeah, much more Miyazaki than Amblin. Although, you know, like I said, I saw E.T. when I was 25, and I saw Paris, Texas the same year. And both of those films are explorations of the feelings of divorce through a child's subjective experience. And they were so resonant for me, and just, but they felt equally valid in their artistic approach. And so I think in a lot of ways, that was what I was writing too, is this these feelings. And so E.T. and Paris, Texas were like, it was always kind of like, what's the unifying feeling between these, you know? That is what I was pursuing.
Gotcha. It is strange for us to see kids' films that kind of take an approach like that. That's not just like a dumbed down experience for kids, or maybe something that's a little too much meant for adults. Like I liked Spike Jonze's What Where the Wild Things Are, but I also felt like that was a movie meant more for the adults who grew up with it rather than
Particularly in
kids
the
getting into it.
middle where they start
Yes.
like talking like they're in therapy and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. When it comes to this film, was there anything beyond the puppetry that you really wanted, that you used to help like convey this town, this vision of Carpathia? Were there models and miniatures and other ways you kind of built out this world?
Well, the world was there. We just went to it. So we shot in Transylvania in these really remote territories, small villages, logging towns, the highest road accessible mountain location in all of Romania. So conveying it was just going there, and we played it for what it was. You know, I only created it as a fantasy island called the Island of Carpathia because I didn't feel like I had the cultural authority to make the story about Romania. But I knew I had a handle of the elements enough that I could create a collage and create a fantasy island, give myself just enough freedom that I could play around and feel okay. And then as the film progresses, it ramps up from purely location shooting into environments that we couldn't find in Romania. I would have shot them on location if they existed, but they don't. And so it was a matter of what can we afford to build? We can afford to build really just the parts the actors are contacting. And then the rest is going to be matte paintings and fully 3D environments that we're going to patiently work on like they are paintings until we get to the point that there's a unified aesthetic across the entire film.
Can you talk about like, because I'm sure you're talking about doing a 3D, you know, kind of environments too. I'm sure there's some CG use in this as well. Can you talk about your vision for how you implement practical effects versus digital effects, basically?
Yeah, that's I do want to say like when a movie comes out with practical effects, all the attention and energy is in celebrating the old craft. And of course I love that. And that's where I come from. It is just the direct immediacy of making practical stuff. But I've also over the years learned CG, and I've made purely animated 3D films, and I know the software myself, and I know that it's a bespoke craft art that is like tedious and full of love and attention to detail, and it doesn't get the respect it deserves, and that's partly because like there's been a kind of corporatization and overuse of CG a lot. But when I'm approaching anything, it's really just knowing the kind of inherent strengths and weaknesses of a technique, and then thinking about what would really make something work and be convincing, and allow the aesthetic control required to get the thing to happen. And so, you know I can't make a CG creature that's going to carry this film. I know that, but I know that also the 3D environment of this river that does not exist in Romania, I'm going to be able to spend the weeks and months necessary to really dial that in and make it perfect rather than shooting in the halfway as cool thing that I can shoot. So it's just, you know, you have to look at each opportunity and come to the technique organically for the task. You can't have like philosophies about this.
Gotcha. I mean, using the right tool for the job, but also it seems like you are taking care to use those tools in thoughtful ways, I guess. And that
100,
I've had to live through the entire, you know, Marvel Cinematic Universe and everything, like as somebody who's reviewing movies weekly. And I have to say, it kind of feels like some of those movies have kind of lost that, especially the ones that rely on shooting on the volume and those LED sets and everything. Can you talk about, like, I don't know if that's something you've had experience with, but how would you approach something like that versus what you've done for OG? And I don't want to ruin any potential you have for Marvel right now, but you know,
no,
but,
not
you know,
at all. I mean, I have no plans to ever make a Marvel film or any IP.
That's what they all say. Let me tell me.
I've already said no.
Okay. Yeah.
But, you know, this film does have a lot of situations which had to be approached not that differently than a Marvel film. So, you know, as I said, the third act had unfilmable locations, things that didn't exist or were unsafe to access, like rivers, caves, things that had a certain scale that I couldn't access. And so what we're shooting is just these little patches of sets that we can afford to construct so that at least the contact with the actors is real. And it's all set extensions, which are either a 2D map painting that I'm doing or a 3D modeled environment that we're spending a lot of time, you know, texturing and lighting. And that's what Marvel does too. So it's not necessarily like categorically different. It's more in the attention to detail, the patience. You know, I didn't have money on this this movie, but I had time. You know, we were in post for 3 years. So I used that privilege of getting it right and doing revisions on the backgrounds myself and painting over and saying, you know, this is good, but here's what it could be. And I just send that back to the 3D artist and we just keep going until it's there.
Yeah. You know? I've had a lot of conversations with VFX artists and it sounds like it's mostly they're rushed in all these projects and they don't have time. Yeah.
Every single VFX house is full of the most talented, incredible people. Yeah. And all the complaints around the use of CG and VFX have to do with corporate processes that don't provide enough time and shot planning and shot design.
Yeah.
And so a lot of it also falls to the directors and that they are, maybe they made some dialogue-driven drama indie movie and the studio's logic is, okay, they know how to work with actors.
Right.
We'll put them in the world-building role. We'll pay for the world-building. But then actually, there's a whole missing skill set, which is designing a film from the ground up for world building. And not a lot of directors have that mindset. And then the VFX artist is supposed to just, you know, do it in no time. And it's,
Yeah. And change things at the drop of a hat. It seems really unfair. Yeah. To the artist. I'd mentioned enjoying your video for Bjork's Wanderlust. Wondering if there's anything you learned from that experience of producing that video or just working with Bjork in general, who is a creative, you know, genius and somebody I've loved forever. Has her influence or anything, you know, influenced this film?
Yeah, I always said she was the patron saint of this film. you know, she's the spirit in this film. And she and I just share a lot of philosophical views on the world and an approach to art making also that embraces technology as a form of nature. You know, it's an outgrowth of nature. It's not in opposition to it. So Bjork's just a wonderful friend and guiding light through this process. What was the other component of your question?
From producing Wanderlust as
well. What did I learn from Wanderlust? I mean, Wanderlust was the first time I put everything together. You know, I was only 23 and I, you know, had never used any CG and I had never really had a budget to build what I wanted to build. So we got to build miniatures and giant puppets puppeteered by multiple people and people in prosthetic costumes and doing wild dance and stunt work and then, you know, do a fully matte painted world and then a CG river. And so all of those, a lot of that stuff was new to me. You know, I'd been doing models and some prosthetics, but this was like the level up. And it also kind of broke me. And it I was so physically exhausted from this, you know, because we had like $130,000 to make that. So it was just like 9 months of blood, sweat, and tears. But it put us on the map. But it I then just kind of retreated into the forest for a few years writing a feature that didn't get made, but you know, it was like the pain of building, of doing it this way. Like you have a gun to your head with a shooting schedule and you have Murphy's Law and it's just brutal and it's hard. And I needed to actually do animated films for a bit just to like recuperate and just and to have a relaxing relationship to work where you could just kind of, you know, patiently improve things. Gotcha. Unlike physical shooting. Yeah.
Was last question for you. You were mentioning you were writing a film. Was that DIY that you were referring
to?
Yeah,
exactly.
See that reference for you. And you started DIY.org, which is a really cool project in terms of like getting kids and showing like how you can actually make things. Can you talk a bit about that too? Because you're a tech founder, technically, I guess, or a site founder. Yeah.
Yeah. So as I was just saying, we went to the woods because we were burnt out, and I invited all my friends to come with me, and you know, a big group of us learned how to build tree houses and huts and learn how to farm out in the mountains of Redwood Forest of Santa Cruz. And as we were doing that, just kind of driven by like the joy of learning and looking something up on YouTube and realizing you could just like do it. We realized that was like a really important almost pedagogy for right. just all education, that like I wish that this was what school was like when I was a kid. Just do and you'll learn by doing. And as I was, you know, thinking about that, we started writing the movie DIY, me and Sean and Darren, and with help from my wife Mira O'Reilly. And it was about a gang of kids who rebuild their town improvisationally after a natural disaster. And, you know, we had a big studio behind us. We had J.J. Abrams producing. Mm-hmm. And that's when I met this guy, Zach Klein, who had founded Vimeo and sold Vimeo. And he's a wonderful guy who was a former Eagle Scout. And he was really inspired by the movie idea. And we said, what if we built a real world organization that could provide structure, you know, for this type of learning? And also, you know, what if you built Scouts now? What would you do, you know, with the internet? And it was an optimistic time in the internet's history where we had Kickstarter had just happened, and like there really wasn't yet like super toxic social media, and certainly not AI and all these other things that came later. And the phone was kind of like new, and like, wonder what we could do with it, you know, as a learning tool. So that's the spirit. We founded DIY.org, and we, you know, for many years, it was just like learning for kids. You could upload any evidence of your creativity, and then we'd send you an embroidered patch for doing the skill. And it has since, we had to, you know, it didn't actually really fully succeed as a profitable endeavor, and you know, we had to basically sell it just to have it not disappear. So other people control it now, and I don't have any influence over it, and it's not exactly what we made. It's I hope still a force for good, and I think it's mostly like tutorial videos for kids now, but you know, it exists. But yeah, the DIY in 2012 was like really all my focus. I spent 2 years there just working on the curriculum of it all for kids.
Yeah. That's cool. I mean, going from York to doing, you know, DIY work for kids in the forest, that sounds fun. That's a good thing. Well, Isaiah, thank you so much for chatting with us. Congrats on the film, and I hope to chat with you again soon. Okay.
I appreciate all your questions and thoughtfulness, and thank you so much.
Wait. Hi, this is Elon Musk. Welcome to Palo Alto, the home of Tesla engineering. You know, they say money can't buy happiness, and yeah, okay. I guess that's true. God knows I've tried, but it can buy a Cybertruck, and that's pretty sick, right?